This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. There was a time, not very long ago, that Liz Cheney was a big deal, a serious contender in Republican politics. She obviously came from a Washington power family. She's the daughter of Vice President Dick Cheney, and her mother is Lynn Cheney, who chaired the National Endowment for the Humanities. Early on, Liz Cheney worked in the State Department before running for office from the state of Wyoming. In Congress, she quickly rose to be the number three Republican. In other words, Liz Cheney was every bit the conservative Washington insider. She was totally on board when Donald Trump came to town and voted with his positions a remarkable 93% of the time. But finally, at the end of the Trump administration, she broke with Trump. She balked. She wouldn't go along with Republicans who ignored or amplified the stream of dangerous lies about the 2020 election. And in the aftermath of January 6, she voted to impeach Donald Trump, something that only 10 Republicans did. And that was it. Republicans in Washington and back in Wyoming stripped Liz Cheney of her party positions. They censured her. And finally, she lost a primary election very badly. Cheney recounts all of this in a new book with the title Oath and Honor. We spoke last week. I think we should start out with the most important thing of all. In 2024, would you say that the United States is poised to potentially elect an aspiring dictator?
I think there's no question. And I think one of our challenges, those of us who recognize the threat, is to be able to convey how perilous the moment is, because it's something we've never faced before, as you know, in this country. And so it can be very challenging to convince people that's in fact where we are, but it certainly is where we are.
You've used the phrase sleepwalking toward dictatorship. What does that mean?
It means that we're gradually accepting things that we would never have accepted previously. Even if you just look at January 6th and at what people agreed right after January 6th, certainly almost every Republican in Congress knew Donald Trump was responsible and, you know, had prepared on the House side a censure resolution that mirrored the language of the impeachment article. It was a moment where people really understood what he had done was unacceptable, not to mention unconstitutional and illegal. And that recognition very quickly, though, dwindled. And we've come to accept things now in terms of what he says, what he's doing. And his playbook in some cases is to say things that are so extreme that many people listening sort of have discounted it and have said he can't possibly mean that.
Many dictators have been elected to their perch. Hitler was elected. What is the potential for Trump to be elected? I mean, what do you think the odds are? And once elected, how would he be different in 2024, 2025 than he was from 2016 to the end of his term?
I think the potential is very real. He obviously is leading by a significant margin in the Republican primary race, and anybody who thinks that he can't win the general, I think that's wishful thinking. We know that he's willing to seize power. He's had a dry run. You know, if you look at the story of the Select Committee, for example, the witnesses that we put on, you know, at the time when I heard, for example, General Mike Flynn suggest the president should deploy the military to rerun the election in swing states, I had no idea that he, you know, actually was contemplating doing that. And if you think about what it means that he's talked already about putting Mike Flynn back into positions of power, I think there's no question that he'll do that if given the opportunity, if he needs to.
General Flynn, do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified morally?
Take the Fifth.
You believe the violence on January 6th was justified legally?
Fifth.
General Flynn, do you believe in the peaceful transition of power in the United States of America?
The Fifth.
In a second Trump term, He won't obey the rulings of the courts. He'll offer pardons to people who do his bidding. People need to take very seriously the fact that he has practiced. He's told us what he'll do, and he'll certainly do it again. And he'll be better at it, and he'll be surrounded by people who will help him rather than prevent him.
I think it's fair to say in 2016, when he was elected, people on my side of the political block were appalled, terrified, full of warning and foreboding and all the rest. Did you not feel the same way right from the get-go with Trump, or did your sense of him evolve? Did you have optimism about Donald Trump?
What I remember thinking was, and part of this is informed by the fact that I'd worked at the State Department. I certainly, you know, grew up around politics and you know, in and out of the White House. So I knew about the structures that are in place that are there to help serve American presidents, the structure at the National Security Council, the structure of the Executive Secretariat in the White House. And I thought Trump would grow into the job. I thought, like I think many Republicans did, that those structures around him would inform him and that he'd grow into the job.
But what in his behavior led you to think so, or was it you wished it would be so?
It was what I had seen happen before.
Right.
And I think that was the mistake. You know, when you start to think about the things that he did, and these were things that I spoke out about as they were happening, you know, when he stood next to Putin in Helsinki and mm-hmm. said he trusted Putin more than his own intelligence services, or when he suggested America should you know, pull out of NATO, that NATO's obsolete. It's the same thing that we're suffering from now in some ways. It's hard to imagine an American president as dangerous as he was. We have not ever faced a danger like this, and we've seen what it'll do.
I guess I want to get a sense of what it was like in private meetings among Republicans in the Republican caucus, how Trump was talked about beginning in 2016 right through 2020, because obviously people would come, you yourself voted with him over 90% of the time. But how were you and your colleagues talking about him as opposed to what they were saying in public?
I think there was a view that the policies in many ways were policies I agreed with, policies that many Republicans agreed with. I would say up until really the 2020 election, and there were periods of time certainly leading up to that where he said things like maybe we can delay the election. But the real sort of turning point in my mind obviously came in the days after the 2020 election, as it became clear that he was taking steps that increasingly looked like he might not leave office.
Well, you said that the cause of our time is not to become numb. As somebody who's inside the Republican Party, inside those cloakrooms, what has allowed your colleagues or former colleagues in the party to become numb? Is it personal ambition? Is it a strange sense of idealism gone wrong? Is it so great being a congressman or a senator that you keep cling on to your job no matter what? Is it so swell?
It's all of those things. I don't think that there's a lot of idealism in there, though. I think that the very small number, and I think it's single digits of members who actually believe Trump. You know, that's one group. But you have a much larger group. You've got over 80 Republicans.
You think it's in single digits that they actually believe him, and everybody else
House.
Is just pretending.
Yes, yes, for sure. Now, I think that beyond that, though, you've got people who, some of whom have made a calculated decision. Look, you know, this is my political future. If I want to survive, I've got to be an aggressive supporter of Donald Trump's. And I mean, look, psychologically, if you've embraced him after he tried to seize power and, you know, launched a violent mob to assault the Capitol, then you know, you really can never go back because you've sort of accepted a line that can never be crossed. But then I think you also have a lot of Republicans who really just don't want to deal with it, who believed that he was going to fade away, that we didn't have to deal with it, that talking about it was what gave him power, and so sort of put their head in the sand and hope for the best.
Let's talk about the election for a second. The Democrats obviously are running their incumbent, Joe Biden. Are the Democrats making a mistake running someone in their 80s? Is this part of sleepwalking toward disaster?
I think there are a whole range of issues right now that are causing independents to have real concern. And I don't hear from people who say to me that they might vote for Trump. I hear from people saying to me, if the Democrats don't get their act together on the border, for example, you know, you're going to have people who vote for Trump because they think that he's the lesser of two evils here. I don't think either party's nominee is, you know, all sewn up yet. But I think that we face a situation where people could decide, they think, you know, it can't possibly be that Trump is this bad, so we're going to go ahead and cast a vote for him. And those are the people that we really have to reach and convince.
Are you ready to pull the lever for Joe Biden, or are you considering running yourself?
I have said that I'm going to do whatever it takes to stop Trump, and I haven't made a decision yet about, you know, whether or not I'm going to run. I'll make that decision in the next couple of months. But I think all of those options have to be on the table. But I do think that we're at a moment in American politics where a third party option has got to be given consideration that it wouldn't have been before.
I'm assuming neither Cornel West nor Robert F. Kennedy Jr. excite you.
No, that's a correct assumption.
Fair enough. Liz Cheney's new book is called Oath and Honor. Our conversation continues in a moment on the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I'm speaking today with Liz Cheney, the former Republican representative from the state of Wyoming. Cheney is a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. She voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and in 2020, but she broke with him after the 2020 election. And ultimately, she played a major role on Congress's select committee investigating January 6. She didn't pull any punches in those hearings or in her new book, which is called Oath and Honor. Earlier in our conversation, I asked if, assuming Republicans nominate Donald Trump, she would support Joe Biden, or if Cheney is going to run for president herself on a third party line. She told us she's weighing those decisions right now. You're an ardent conservative, always have been. You've spent a lot of time lately with Democrats. You've been sitting next to Jamie Raskin and all the people on the committee, not your normal allies in the past. What do you want to say to them about the Democratic Party in order to broaden its appeal? In other words, what in your view as a conservative, what mistakes in terms of policy or appeal or rhetoric or tactics do you want to see the Democrats correct in order to prevent Trump from winning?
When I think about what's happening right now in the Democratic Party, the first thing that causes me deep concern is rising anti-Semitism. And, you know, I've been very, very open and clear about anti-Semitism on the right. We certainly saw that as a big part of January 6th, white supremacy. But what's happening now today is terrifying. When I see people threatening that they're, you know, going to take their support away from Joe Biden, away from Democrats, if they stand with Israel, if they stand against anti-Semitism, that's a really dangerous place for the country. I think across the board on policy issues, what's happening at the border, I would say, is just, you've got Democratic mayors and governors around the country saying to the Biden administration, you have to get control. And though that kind of the policies that we're seeing or the lack of policies that we're seeing at the border are exactly the kind of thing that could lead people to say, this chaos is something we can't sustain. We're gonna vote for Donald Trump. I think on issues like crime around the country, I would tell the Democrats, you've got to get your act together on some pretty basic things that ought to be common sense. And on the Democratic side, I think people have lost the ability, again, to talk about the goodness and the greatness of this country. And I think that has an impact.
There are a lot of interesting moments in this book. One of them is you write about turning down an invitation to talk to Trump in March 2021. Why did you turn down that opportunity, if that's what it was?
I was very surprised by this phone call. This was a call from Brian Kilmeade, who
of Fox
was somebody,
News.
Yes, I'd known Brian. I was myself an analyst at a contributor at Fox News for a number of years, and Brian called me to say, I think you guys essentially need to bury the hatchet. And when he called me, I was surprised, but I also was surprised when I laid out for him why I wouldn't talk to Trump. His response was
What was
not,
your reasoning? Forgive my interrupting, but what
no,
was your reasoning?
I said, we're not having a disagreement here. He violated the Constitution. He went to war with the rule of law. You know, this isn't about burying the hatchet. What he's done is you know, a line that can't be crossed.
You're not disagreeing about tax policy.
Right. But Brian's response was essentially not to disagree with me. He basically said, yes, I realize that. I know that that's the case. He said, but what if he's our only hope to beat Kamala? Which was surprising to me that somebody would sort of say out loud, you know, okay, he might be that bad. He might have violated the Constitution, but, you know, we got to beat the Democrats.
Well, what does that tell you about him? Kilmeade.
I mean, I think that he was expressing a view that not only he holds, and I think this is where, as people who believe in conservative principles, we have a special duty to say, you know, we aren't going to torch the Constitution in order to win the next election.
And yet you voted for Trump in 2020. It was your rationale that really only winning matters here from an ideological point of view, or had the scales not fallen from your eyes yet? It wasn't until the election drama, post-election drama.
Well, I certainly wish that I hadn't, but I wouldn't say it was about winning is the only thing that matters. I mean, it goes back to what we were discussing earlier in terms of, you know, the policies that really mattered from my perspective for the people that I was representing. There were many moments where I thought, all right, look, you know, this is going to proceed now. We've had the election. He lost. And this is going to now become a normal transition. And it became clear sort of day by day that wasn't going to be the case.
You write quite a lot about Mike Johnson, who is now the Speaker of the House. As you write, he was one of the main architects of the House's effort to support Trump in overturning the election. How concerning is it to you that he's now the Speaker, a collaborator, as you put it, in the Speaker's chair?
It's very concerning. The Speaker of the House is second in line to the presidency behind the vice president. And if you think about where we could be, you know, the new Congress will be sworn in on January 3rd, 2025, and the electoral votes will be counted on January 6th. If no candidate has reached 270, then we could have a contingent election. And Johnson in the Speaker's chair then, in my view, given what I have seen, given what I know about how he operates, how he operated, he cannot be counted on to put his duty to the Constitution ahead of his determination to appease Donald Trump. And I don't say that lightly. I say that as someone who, you know, used to be a friend of Mike's. I considered him a friend, but it's a very real concern. And it's not only me. I mean, during the period of time that we were having these debates, you know, I was working very closely with Kevin McCarthy's chief counsel, and she shared my view, and I tell those stories in the book about Johnson's willingness to advocate positions that he knew were constitutionally infirm.
How does he square that with his immense moral bearing?
I mean, I think that is a question.
He says everything he believes is in the Bible.
Yeah. Well, look, I certainly don't want to question his faith, but what I can tell you is that I watched him operate, and the way he operated was destructive, and advocated things. I mean, if you just look at the fact that he stood on the floor of the House and objected to the Arizona electoral votes, mm-hmm. in a way that would suggest certainly that we should throw out those votes, which would mean throwing out the votes of millions of Americans. And he had never before January 6th, that I knew of, expressed any concern about Arizona's votes. His concerns were all focused on four other states. And he had no answer to a really important question that a number of Republicans asked, which was, if you're worried about rule changes, why aren't you talking about those states that have changed the rules prior to the election that elected in states where Trump won. You know, the objections were only focused on states that Biden had won. And certainly, you know, the objections were being made despite the fact that the courts had ruled already. But I think that's, you know, an important insight into why, to what was driving those objections.
I have to ask you, does it feel a little strange to you, considering your political career and your voting record, to be lionized, at least by some on the left at this point?
Yeah, I mean,
yes, it's
disconcerting.
Is the answer. It's disconcerting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure people on the left find it strange also. But I think that it really reflects the unique peril of the moment that we're coming together to say, put politics and partisanship aside. There's something much more important that we have to do here.
And that's the first line of the book. This is the story of the moment when American democracy began to unravel. Was it in such good shape before that?
Look, it is not a perfect system, obviously, but it's a system that we have been blessed ever since the presidency of George Washington with, you know, presidents who recognized and understood their obligation and duty, and particularly their obligation and duty to ensure the peaceful transfer of power. And we have never had someone who was willing to sort of blow through all of the guardrails. I think that there are always things we can do to help improve our system. You and I might disagree on what some of those are, but you can put in place the most sort of well-organized series of laws. And if you elect somebody who doesn't care, if you elect somebody who's willing to refuse to abide by the rulings of the courts, those structures won't save us. It's really the people that do that. We know from testimony in the Select Committee, and I talk about this in the book, that on January 6th, as he sat in his dining room and watched the violence on television, one of the White House employees who testified to the committee told us they saw the note sitting in front of him that said that there had been a civilian who'd suffered a gunshot wound at the entrance to the House chamber. Sat on the table in front of him, he knew it, and yet he still wouldn't tell the mob to stop. He wouldn't tell them to go home. And I think that that's so important for people to remember, you know, what kind of a human being does that. And it seems so clear and so obvious that we can't take the risk of entrusting him with power again.
He has been charged as liable for rape. He has 91 federal counts against him. I could go on and on. Do you think if convicted, he should go to jail?
I do. Again, that's going to be up to our justice system, to a jury of his peers, to the judges involved. I think it's fundamental to who we are as a country that no person's above the law. And if he is convicted and sentenced to serve time, I think certainly that's what has to happen.
Liz Cheney, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Wonderful to be with you.
Liz Cheney is a former representative from the state of Wyoming. Her new book has the title Oath and Honor, a memoir and a warning. If you missed any of our conversation, you can find it on the podcast of the New Yorker Radio Hour. We're going to switch gears in a moment, and we'll talk country music with the acclaimed songwriter Brandi Clark. So stick around.
Tell her you don't love her, even if it's a lie. Make it sound true. Break that spell she's under, even if it feels mean. Do what you gotta do. Don't leave a doubt. Don't break her fall. Don't see her out. Don't tell her you'll call. Tell her you don't love her, if you ever loved her.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
She smoked in the house, burned holes in the couch, lipstick circled butts in the ashtray.
In 2020, The New Yorker published an article with the headline, "No one is writing better country songs than Brandi Clark is." Those songs have been performed by the likes of Reba McEntire, Miranda Lambert, Kacey Musgraves, Leanne Rimes, all the biggest artists in country music. And Brandi Clark herself is one of the top songwriters in Nashville, often co-writing with Shane McAnally. But growing up in the state of Washington in a town of just 1,000 people, Brandi Clark's first musical partner was her mother.
You know, I never realized that everybody's mom couldn't play a bunch of instruments. You know, my mom, we always had a piano, and I remember some of my earliest memories of her. She played the harp and the hammered dulcimer. She could just pick up an instrument and learn it. So, you know, if there was a song on the radio that we loved, she could play it. She played by ear really well. And then later on, we were in a band together. And a lot of my first songs I wrote with my mom. I did have a knack for that. And the original songs that our band did, people gravitated towards. And so that was really what got me to move to Nashville.
After making it there as a writer, Clark's first album performing her own material was called 12 Stories, a record that staff writer Emily Nussbaum describes as a masterpiece. Emily is a fan of country music, and she sat down with Brandi Clark to talk about her newest album, which is called, logically enough, Brandi Clark. And it's been nominated for 5 Grammy Awards. Here's Emily.
So let's talk about your move to Nashville. You moved there when you were 22.
Yes.
You went to Belmont. What were you thinking about doing professionally at that point? Being a songwriter, being in the music industry, being an artist, solo artist?
Yes, I definitely wanted to be a solo artist at that point. And what happened to me was, like, you know, you move a new place and you make friends. And I started to see that my friends that were getting traction as artists, they cared way more about, which you wouldn't know this today because I just came from a TV appearance, they cared way more about hair and makeup than I did. And that seemed to be more of what mattered, you know, was what you looked like. And I cared more about learning to write songs. I wasn't going to skip a writing appointment to go get a spray tan. You know, and friends I had, no offense, we all choose what's important to us. They were into doing that, and they were getting traction. They were getting record deals. They were being successful. And so I started to think, maybe I'm not an artist. Like, maybe that whole aesthetic thing is so much more important than I ever realized. And so, but I love music so much, and I loved getting better as a songwriter. I loved people, actually, this is going to sound crazy, but it's true. I loved people telling me my songs weren't good enough because it made me want to get better and want to study great songs and learn how to get better. And that's what motivates me, is doing something musically that moves somebody, you know, that just, so that's where I was really motivated.
How much did your sexuality play a role in any of your decisions at that time? I know you've talked about yourself as being a late bloomer, but...
It definitely played into it, you know, because about the time I moved to Nashville, I did realize that I was gay, and I got into my first relationship, and I knew that I didn't think those two things could coexist, which was being in a relationship that was authentic to me and being a country music artist. That played into it massively, I would say.
Could you tell me about the environment? Did you get that as advice from people? Did people say, you can't come out and be an artist, you have to do other things? Or was it more in the atmosphere?
It was more in the atmosphere because I was a long ways from coming out at that point, too. And I also wasn't good enough at my craft where anybody would have cared enough to say, don't come out of the closet, you could ruin this. You know, like I wasn't there as an artist for sure. It took me living a little to have something to really say as an artist, but I definitely didn't think that those two things could be together.
Could coexist.
Yeah.
How old were you when you met Shane McAnally? He's been a frequent collaborator with you.
Oh, yeah. Shane, I was in my 30s. Man, let me think of exactly how old I was. I'll tell you what, it was an amazing day, the day that I met Shane. And some of it had to do, you know, you mentioned my sexuality. Some of it was that, you know, I saw him, and I was out of the closet by then, but I saw him. It's one thing to be an out-of-the-closet lesbian, it's another thing to be an out-of-the-closet gay man, you know, living and working in country music. And I thought that was so brave. From the moment I met him, he was who he was. And I thought, you know what? I mean, I was living my life out loud. But when I met Shane, I thought, you know what? You're not living it out loud enough. Like, just be who you are. And I remember he said something to me one time. I said, because then I did get the opportunity to make a record and things started to happen. And I said, Shane, do you think it's going to matter that I'm gay? And he said, nope, you're too good. It won't matter. And that really stuck with me.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your album, Brandi Clark. It's your fourth album. It's the first one that has your name on it in that way. And I know it was originally called Northwest. How did it change to be called Brandi Clark?
So I wanted to call it Northwest because Brandi Carlile, when she approached me about making this record, she said, I see it as your return to the Northwest. And because we grew up close to each other, didn't know each other, but, you know, same side of the state. And I loved that. I never really dove into talking about the Northwest specifically. And so went to the Northwest and wrote a song called Northwest and was like, this is the album title. But when I would tell people that, they would say, well, you know, that's Kim and Kanye's child, right? And I had never occurred
to me.
Me neither.
Yeah.
And so the first time someone said that, I just thought, oh, you know, they like bad TV, as do I. But when like 4 out of 5 people said it, I thought, okay, this is not really, really a good thing. And no offense to Northwest, the child. But as we started working on the record, it just was so me. It felt so me that I wanted to call it Brandi Clark. You know, working with Brandi Carlile did bring me home, not just to the Northwest, but home musically for me. And so it felt like, wow, this is, of the 4 albums, this one is the most authentically me.
Well, let's play a song from the album, just this absolutely stunning song called Buried. Could you tell me a little bit about it and then we can have you play it?
Oh, thank you. So Buried, I wrote this with Jesse Joe Dillon, and I think that, you know, we all have somebody that we'll love till we're buried that we're usually not with. So her and I sat down one day and we started it from the top. I had the working title, If You Don't Love Me Anymore. And all these things that, you know, you're going to do. And that song changed a lot in the studio because Brandi really challenged me to change the second verse. It used to say, I'll read Lonesome Dove, I'll start doing yoga. And she didn't like that yoga line. And I did. And I said, well, you know, why don't you like it? She said, well, because I just don't even believe you do yoga. And I said, well, I don't. She said, well, then why would you put it in a song? You know, so there were some little things like that that changed. And she said to me, you know, I know you're calling this song If You Don't Love Me Anymore, but I think you should call it Buried. It's the last word of the song. It's such a powerful title. It's really what it's about. And so that's how the title changed, some lyric changed. More things changed on that song lyrically than any song I've ever written in the studio.
I have to say the Kiss Me on the Dance Floor line to me, and I don't know whether this is an overread, but that actually does feel a little bit about being with somebody who's not out. I don't know whether, yeah.
For me, that is what that was about. You know, wanting to be with somebody who's proud enough to be with you in the open.
So let's have you sing the song, The Beautiful Buried.
Okay.
I'll fly myself to France, first class New York to Paris, get drunk on wine and dance with someone who ain't embarrassed to kiss me on the dance floor. Yeah, that's what I'll be there for. If you don't want me, if don't love me anymore. I'll read Lonesome Dove, fall asleep to Hallelujah. I'll take some trippy drug, makes me forget I even knew ya. I'll paint the floor to ceiling blue. Leave me, baby, I got things to do. If you don't want me, make you a believer that I don't love you either. I'll meet somebody else, probably get married. I'll keep it to myself. I love you till I'm buried.
It's unbelievably beautiful. Literally, I have chills running up the back of my neck. And I also find that song so beautiful because it's like a trick ending, but not in a gimmick way. It mm-hmm. actually is very, very devastating. But tell me a little bit about the vocal for this, because it's a very quiet, mm-hmm. quiet song on it. And the album itself is a quiet album in many ways, other than the first
yeah.
track.
So this vocal, you know, I had been in Salt Lake City working on Shucked before it went to Broadway. And Brandy and I were working at Shangri-La Studios in Malibu, California. And I got a phone call from our producer of our musical, and he asked me if I could step out and talk to him. And so I did, and he told me that we were losing a cast member to another show. And somebody that I felt like the show, that was in the DNA, and I cried. And when I came back in, Brandy was like, hey, let's do Buried. And I said, oh, you know, I just got some news. It's not terrible, but it's kind of shaken me up. And she's like, no, you know, we won't keep your vocal. Like, let's just do it, which was really smart of her. So I was in this very vulnerable, sad place to sing it. And then she had the engineer turn my mic up so hot that I had to whisper sing it. And that's where all that comes from.
So what choices did you make musically on this album about the sound of it, or did you make mutually with Brandy as a producer?
We made choices together, for sure. And she was great for me to work with because I could talk to her like another recording artist. I could say, I want it to feel like this, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be musical language. You know, we wanted it to be live, and it is, for the most part, all live. You know, Brandy had said to me, because I feel like... For a long time, I've straddled country and Americana. And she said, you know, I think as a producer, I can pull you over into more of an Americana vibe on a record. And so that was a conscious choice.
So could you tell me what that means? Because I was surprised. This album is nominated, correct, as an Americana album. And tell me, from your perspective, what's the difference between country and Americana?
Well, and it's just so I'm clear on it, it's nominated across both.
Right. It's nominated as Best Americana uh-huh. Album, but Buried is nominated as
Best Country Song.
Best Country Song and Best Country Vocal.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, you know, I think with Americana, it's more, to me, it means more acoustic instruments, less electric instruments, although there are some electric instruments. And it's kind of dirtier. I mean, there's nothing slick to me about Americana. It's, you know, it's, and that can be hard for me because there were things that Brandy and the engineer fought me on to keep that were imperfect. Those are, that's tough things for me.
Can you give me an example?
Well, that buried vocal.
Right.
You know, that was a really great example. And then when people, what helped me was when people would hear it, they'd be like, don't change a note. You know, I think Americana, the Americana space is less about, well, it's definitely less about anything that might commercially work on radio, even though I do get Americana radio play. I mean, I kind of just think it's Americana is good music. And that sounds really vague, but it's a pretty broad genre.
You know, it's complicated because I did this whole article about Nashville, and I would ask everyone to define the categories, and some people would define them in ways that had very little to do with the music. They would just say Americana is more diverse. Americana is liberal country.
Yes.
Americana makes less money because it's not connected to country radio.
Yeah, I have heard Americana is country music for Democrats.
Yeah.
I have heard that, which I really liked that.
I want to talk actually about another song on the album that I also love, Tell Her You Don't Love Her. And, you know, I know that that song changed a lot in production as well. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
I think that, to me, to have a song on a record that's not bashing another woman, that is, like, literally, like, I love my friend. And you don't. You need to tell her. You know, stop kind of, you know, keeping her hanging.
Tell her you don't love her, even if it's a lie. Make it sound true. Break that spell she's under, even if it feels mean. Do what you gotta do. Don't leave a doubt. Don't break her fall. See her out, don't tell her you'll call. Tell her you don't love her, if you ever loved her at all.
And that's, to me also, that came from a really real situation. That was really going on.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful, and it comes from this interesting emotional angle that's indirect and has this edge of anger in a way that's earned but not directed at a person hurting you.
I mean, I've been in love with people that other people had to say to me, look, you're never going to get it together. So I just thought it was – I think it's an important song for that reason.
You know, I'm interested in that experience of being a songwriter. And I think a lot of people listening to this probably don't understand what it's like to be a music row songwriter. Like, what is the daily experience of that job compared to the job that you're doing now?
Well, for me, it never really stopped. You know, like, I was always looking for song. I still am always looking for song ideas. But, you know, you've got to go in every day at 10 a.m. with a list of ideas to fire off at somebody else and see what resonates. And it might not be your idea. It might be theirs. You know, if you're writing with an artist, you're writing for them. And so, you know, that was always a delicate balance of, you know, with my experience, and I even see it in myself as my own artist, artists usually like their ideas. You know, when I look at my albums, most of the titles were my idea because it's what I feel close to. So as a songwriter, you put on your hat to be in service to their idea. And sometimes you compromise on things that if they weren't in the room, you wouldn't. We're trying to write the best song we can write for the world. If we were sitting there with an artist, we're still trying to do that, but we're trying to do it through their lens. And so I think songwriters who are really good at that are really good at staying out of the way. And I mean that positively. Like, they're really good at pulling the best out of others and helping an artist get their vision out fully.
You're behind a bunch of songs that other songwriters did that became classics, including Mama's Broken Heart, Better Dig Two, Follow Your Arrow. Was Was it ever hard to have somebody else do the song instead of you doing the song?
No, not with those three, because those are great, three great examples. You know, Follow Your Arrow, Shane and I wrote that with Casey Musgraves. That was always for Casey. You know, so we wrote that with her and for her. Mama's Broken Heart. I mean, I love to play that every once in a while. It gets a crowd rowdy, but I never was connected to it. I don't have any of those stories where it's like, oh, it pains me that this person recorded that song. I also believe songs end up where they're supposed to, especially if they're songs that are hit songs or get some sort of a critical look, you know, like, because I have songs that that have been recorded that weren't hits, but that people know. And it's like, okay, that ended up where it was supposed to be.
Back when you made 12 Stories, what was the psychological adjustment like from being a songwriter for other people to being a front woman?
Well, you know, it was a slow one. I feel like I've just, with this record, fully made it. You know, that was one of the things that Brandy said to me. She's like, you think of yourself too much as a craftsman. You know, like, even in interviews like this one, I've mentioned other co-writers. And she was like, you've got to stop doing that. She's like, you got to stop talking about me so much, which I'm not going to do. Sorry to tell you, Brandy Carlile. I will always, you know, bang her drum. But she's like, it's about you. You're the artist. And so I think that was a big shift. And this is the first album where I've had so many songs that are really about me. You know, I no longer write songs thinking, now, would Leanne Womack want to say this? You know, I used to always have that voice in my head. I use Leanne Womack because I always wanted her to cut my songs. But I don't feel that. I don't do that anymore. And so that was that adjustment took some time.
Thank you so much for coming by. It was great. And thank you for playing for us.
Oh, thank you.
Brandi Clark's new record, her fourth solo album, is called Brandi Clark. And you can read Emily Nussbaum at newyorker.com. That's the program for today. And we'll close with just a little bit more from Brandi Clark, recorded in our studio, this one called Pray to Jesus. Thanks for listening.
We live in trailers and apartments too, from California to Kalamazoo. Grow up getting married, and when that one ends, we hate sleeping alone, so we get married again. Don't wanna be buried in debt or in sin, so we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto, cause there ain't but two ways we can change tomorrow, and it ain't no genie. So we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto. We love to complain about what we can't fix, mostly mothers-in-law, traffic, and politics. We tell our kids how hard it was back when, same way our parents did to us back. Be different, but we're just like them. So we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto, cause there ain't but two ways we can change tomorrow, and it ain't no genie and it ain't no bottle. So we pray to Jesus and we play.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kyle Alia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett.
And we had additional help this week from Jared Paul and Jake Loomis.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.